We're talking about Governor Tony Evers' education proposals ahead of his first budget that comes out Thursday. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The across-the-aisle clash over education policy is just one of the budget battles that will loom large for the governor as he works to find compromise with the Republican-controlled legislature. One point we'll get at is this. What do you think of Governor Evers' plans to limit the state's voucher and charter school programs? Do you have kids that attend a private voucher school or charter school, or are you a teacher at one of these schools? Do you worry about Governor Evers' plan to freeze voucher enrollment and suspend charter creation? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. Molly Beck is a Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Molly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So in terms of Governor Evers' education policy, let's first look at this issue over private voucher schools and independent charter schools. Mm-hmm. Can you remind us first what private voucher schools are and what the governor is proposing to do with them?
Right. So private voucher schools are schools that are participating in a state program that allows students to attend their private schools using a taxpayer-funded voucher. So every student that a school that's participating in this program receives is receiving a fixed payment per student that comes from state funding, in some cases other school districts' funding. This Milwaukee is actually the first voucher, private school voucher program in the country. It started in 1990. And then back in when Governor Walker first was elected and Republicans took control of the legislature, both were very big supporters of the private school voucher movement, so to speak. And so they passed several expansions of the private school voucher program. They expanded vouchers out of Milwaukee into Racine and then across the state. So these proposals that Governor Evers is proposing would cap the enrollment in all of those programs. So the enrollment would just be frozen.
And
until,
this goes for charter schools as well, which are schools that receive public funding but operate independently of the state's public school system. What is the governor hoping to do with charter schools?
So until 2023, he's hoping that no new charter schools would be created, basically. So his budget would freeze the authorization authority that UW System has the authority to create charter schools, the city of Milwaukee, places like that. He's freezing that authority or wants to freeze that authority until 2023.
Let's take Mark now joining us from Appleton. Mark, hi, go ahead.
Hi. One of the things that I have not heard much conversation about is the accountability piece with voucher schools or charter schools. One thing that I know that the K-12 system is highly regulated and monitored, but I don't hear that same monitoring or regulation going on with the charters and other schools, vouchers.
So Mark, as I think, is asking here, would regulation be a part of education policy in what the governor is proposing here?
Yes, there are some elements to this program, to this plan that he's proposing in his state budget. One would require private schools to have licensed teachers. So right now, that is not a requirement. And if this was to be put into law, all private school teachers who are at schools that accept voucher students would be required to be licensed.
And so these plans would also impact property taxes. Can you tell us about that element?
Right. So the governor's office is expecting some property tax savings by capping the enrollment in these programs. So in the Milwaukee program, they're expecting the state to save about $3 million in 2021. And then in the Racine and the statewide programs, they're expecting about $24.9 million in property tax savings by limiting the number of students that the state would have to pay for.
We're looking at Governor Evers' education policy and what we might see Thursday as part of his first budget. Molly Beck is our guide. She is a Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Molly, how have critics responded to Governor Evers' plans for Wisconsin's voucher and charter schools? What have Republicans said about it?
Republicans are not happy about these proposals. Voucher advocates, groups that advocate on behalf of charter schools and private voucher schools, they're certainly not happy about this. Republican legislative leaders have said that they would not support this. So Republicans control the state legislature, and once Governor Evers releases his budget and submits it to the legislature on Thursday, they'll take it and they will rewrite it, basically. And they've indicated they will eliminate all of these proposals.
Well, let's move up into higher education. The governor is proposing that undocumented residents be able to pay in-state tuition at both UW System and Wisconsin Technical College System schools. What do we know about the governor's plans here?
So for the UW System, the governor, like you said, wants to be able to allow people who have entered the country illegally to pay in-state tuition at University of Wisconsin System colleges and universities. He also wants to continue a very long-running tuition freeze that he would fund by adding another $150 million. So that would provide the UW System with money to continue that tuition freeze.
Why do we see that the governor is planning to sustain this freeze?
He has said that he wants to, you know, be able to ensure that people that attending these colleges and universities don't see a spike in how much they're paying for them.
And originally, I mean, it was Republicans who put this in place back in 2013, and it was a freeze that was originally put in place then with Republicans after learning that the system was accumulating big reserves while increasing tuition each year.
Mm-hmm.
What do we know about those reserves now and how Evers looks at that pot of money?
The plan doesn't address that, but it does provide money to pay for the freeze, essentially. And that's where the controversy over the tuition freeze was born from. Is there was funding cut from the UW System a few years ago, about $250 million under Governor Walker, but the tuition freeze continued. So the UW System wasn't receiving any new money from tuition costs and also wasn't receiving any money from the state. So this is a little bit different because he does fund.
So when we look at Governor Evers' plans for education policy, how do you expect this budget plan to move through the legislature? Is there room for compromise? And if so, where do you see it?
It's a big question, especially on the K-12 proposals, because what he's proposing is basically to undo everything Republicans have done and really championed over the last 8 years. And the reaction to those proposals specifically has been very, you know, just one voucher advocate said that this would end school choice in Wisconsin as Wisconsinites know it. And that's a very strong statement. So I'm not sure that there's going to be a lot of compromise on the proposals themselves. It's possible they might be used as sort of bargaining chips on other things like Medicaid expansion and things, other things that Governor Evers will probably be proposing in his budget. But I've seen Republican leaders saying that these proposals are making it hard for them to go along with any of it.
Molly, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Beck is a Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The budget talk doesn't stop here this week. Governor Tony Evers will deliver his first state budget address Thursday at 7, and WPR and WPT will bring you live coverage of the speech. Up next, Mattel has introduced new dolls with physical disabilities. We'll talk with two psychologists about diverse representation in toys and how it affects children. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. We're looking at gender representation in children's toys on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Toys are how all kids learn and develop skills, and when gender stereotypes are introduced through toys, that can influence how kids see their future and what possibilities are open to them. We've heard about gender-neutral parenting, where you encourage kids to play with all kinds of toys, not just dolls for girls or trucks for boys. What toys do you remember loving as a kid? Have you ever thought of why they made a lasting impression? Is there a toy you wish you would have that would have been around when you were young? And parents, do you try to introduce your child to a variety of play options? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Erica Weissgram is a psychology professor at UW Stevens Point. Her research focuses on gender development and how cultural gender stereotypes affect children's interest in toys. Erica, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
And Laura Zimmerman is a psychology professor at Shenandoah University in Virginia. Her research focuses on development of young children, gender, media, and the role of culture in shaping behavior and thought. She's also a children's book author. Laura, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Laura, let's start with you. Why do we encourage, first of all, why do we encourage children to play, and specifically with toys?
Because it's so important. I mean, kids are exploring their world, trying to learn what's out there, what to do, and play is huge, and toys are a part of that. I mean, they develop cognitive skills, they develop social skills, all of this through play, particularly in our early years, and obviously toys are a part of that and what directs that play.
Erica, how has our understanding of play evolved over time, and how do toys play a role in that?
Well, toys have actually been a part of our history for a long, long time. It used to be that children didn't have a lot of time to play. Basically, when they were little, they were following around their parents, and their parents were doing many household tasks, doing their jobs, and they were given things that resemble what their parents are doing. So little girls were given dolls because then they weren't playing with the actual baby. They could mimic what their parent was doing. We have some historical evidence that there were dolls from ancient Egypt. There were little boys playing with chariots in ancient Rome to mimic what the adults were doing in those adult roles. So toys were meant to kind of prepare these kids for their adult roles. Once we kind of got to this Industrial Revolution, children got to have a lot more time to play. And the childhood kind of became a little bit longer. They weren't going off to work, you know, at early ages. And with this time to play, it meant that there was a wider variety of toys that they could play with as well. And producing toys just for the sake of play became really popular at the time. So now some of those gender roles continue, as we see in our toy play. But now we also have, you know, a kind of a new era where we can think beyond those gender stereotypes and think about, well, what are these toys doing for the kids' cognitive and social development, as Laura said? And, how can we think about what toys should they be playing with? What skills should they be developing?
Yeah, and as we explore that new era of cognitive development, Laura, what are the developmental benefits of kids interacting with toys? You know, as kids are getting more time to play, more time for make-believe, what is happening in their brains?
And of course, my specialty is our young kids, so our toddlers and particularly our preschoolers when we talk about play. And, I mean, they can learn anything. I mean, take a set of blocks. They're learning about number. They're learning about size. They're learning about comparison. They're learning about spatial skills. They basically explore. They're learning language skills, particularly if parents help scaffold that. Divergent play, which is looking for more than one solution, like Legos, I mean, it's huge for creativity. We know even after they play, if we look at their creativity, it is greater. They're learning about cause and effect. I mean, there's everything is out there that they're learning through play. And obviously, toys are encouraging these different things.
And when did they start to show their preference for the types of toys they want to play with?
I would say largely in preschool. Toddlerhood, yeah, but they're so driven by what they're giving them. Preschool, again, they're going to be influenced, because certainly we can talk about the influence from early on, particularly related to gender. But certainly in preschool, they're very good at voicing what they like and what they don't like.
Erica, the way children play is influenced by several factors, and researchers are studying these. Can you break down the cognitive and the biological and the societal for us and how they all interact?
Absolutely. So we have researchers that are taking multiple perspectives here. Researchers from the biological perspective are really looking at the effects of prenatal hormones on children's toy play. So, for instance, there's a group of individuals that have a disorder called CAH, congenital adrenal hyperplasia, that get an excess amount of androgen or testosterone in the womb. For boys, this doesn't really seem to affect their development very much in terms of their toy play. But for girls, it seems like they have a more masculine-type toy play. They're more interested in traditionally boys' toys and rough-and-tumble play. But they're not as – this is compared to their unaffected sisters. But they're not as interested as other boys with or without CAH. So it just goes to show there's a little bit of an influence of these, you know, prenatal hormones from a biological standpoint, and some researchers are pursuing that line. Other researchers are looking at the social influences. So we know that parents might encourage gender-type toys more than other types of toys, more than neutral toys or toys that go across those gender lines. Peers certainly reinforce those gender lines, where kids can get bullied or teased if they're crossing the gender lines in their play. So peers have a big influence. Same thing with siblings and grandparents, you know, where they're all channeling or shaping kids into the type of toys that they might be interested in. From the cognitive standpoint, kids are learning at that preschool age, like Laura said, they're learning the gender stereotypes of which gender is associated with which toy. They might be learning from direct instruction from their parents or from their peers, or they might even be looking at the, you know, color of the box of the toy or the child that's depicted on the box. And so they're thinking to themselves. So when we say cognitive, we're talking about their thinking. And they're thinking, is this toy for me, for my gender, or is it for another gender? And so those are some of the concerns that, you know, people are looking at in terms of what's driving their toy interests. When you ask how they interact or maybe which one has a greater influence, those are answers that we don't exactly have yet. But it's an interesting area to pursue.
We're looking at how toys influence kids and what gender has to do with it. Two psychologists helping us out. Laura Zimmerman is an author and developmental psychologist. Erica Weissgram is a professor of psychology who studies gender development. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to introduce your child to a variety of play options? What is that experience like, and what have you observed about your child's toy preferences? Laura, is there a divide between what toys kids are attracted to and what they believe is available to them to play with?
And I think they certainly are. Like Erica was saying, we start influencing this very, very early on by what toys we choose, by what we encourage. Certainly when I looked at advertising directed to kids related to toys, we already saw it. I was looking at 3 to 6-year-olds. And I was just showing them ads, say, you know, who are these ads directed to? Who are these toys for? And while they were much more open to saying they could be for both people, when I started looking at what's your favorite toy, it started going along stereotypical lines. And when I watched their emotions, they were more positive, watching things that fit their gender. Boys in particular were much more attentive to boy ads and boy-directed ads and what they liked. And the more they played around boys or the groups there in boys, the more they answered that way. The older they got, the more they answered that way. So certainly, yeah, we're seeing them very much dividing along gender lines on what is a toy for me personally.
Erica, toys are often very gendered, as we're talking about here, just looking at toy aisles in our stores. One can be very pink, the other blue and red. So when do children start to understand this gender, and how does that affect their behavior?
Well, I think that they start understanding the ideas of, well, this is for me or not for me. Pretty early on, in those maybe preschool years, they start gaining this knowledge of gender stereotypes, and they start endorsing them a little bit. So research by Carol Martin has shown that they start with, you know, understanding and building these, we call them gender schemas or these gender ideas, at around age 3. And then it really peaks between age 5 and 7, where they're strictly enforcing the gender lines. They don't want to cross those lines. They don't like other people crossing those lines. And so you do see them getting a little bit more gender typed in their play between the ages of 5 and 7. Beyond 7, they get a few more cognitive skills, and they can start to understand, well, kids can play with what they want to play, but I still prefer to play this way myself.
We are at the intersection of toys and play and gender identities with Laura Zimmerman, an author and developmental psychologist, and Erica Weisgrim, a UW Stevens Point psychology professor who studies gender development. McDonald's just announced that its restaurants in New Zealand, instead of a gender-specific toy with their Happy Meals, they're going to be handing out Roald Dahl books over the next 6 weeks. You can join in with your thoughts on gender and toys at 800-642-1234. What toys do you remember loving as a kid? Have you ever thought of why they made a lasting impression on you? And teachers, how do you expose your students to diverse types of play, and what do they learn? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Coming up next is the news, and we'll continue our conversation about how diverse representation in children's toys and media can impact how kids view themselves and the world. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking gender representation and toys here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Mattel's 60-year-old Barbie franchise saw sales gains in the holiday quarter, and it's set to introduce dolls with physical disabilities in June. Toy sales are big business. This market will grow to more than $24 billion in the U.S. over the next few years, and demand for girls' toys is on the rise, according to industry analysts. But what do gender stereotypes have to do with the toys that catch on? Here's a My Little Pony commercial from 2017. My Little
Pony. Hey, want to be Pinkie Pie?
With new pony friends from My Little Pony, they're a friend at every turn. Discover the magic of friendship with My Little Pony.
Now with new poses and accessories, each sold separately.
Do you have experiences to share about My Little Pony or other specific toys like Legos? And parents, do you try to introduce your child to a variety of play options? What is that experience like? We're at 800-642-1234. Laura Zimmerman is a psychology professor at Shenandoah University in Virginia. And Erica Weisgrim is a psychology professor at UW Stevens Point. Let's go to the phones now with Rebecca joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, good morning, ladies. So as I'm listening to this program on my way into work, I just dropped my son off at school, and he's 4 years old. I grew up in a garage with my dad, and I kid you not, my passion is and always has been muscle cars, classic vehicles. So I'm a banker by day. I play in the garage at night. My husband is very much the opposite. He's the cook in our family. He is a wonderful cook, and I just happen to enjoy building carburetors. So it's very, it's a little bit different of a situation. My son, who, like I said, is 4 years old, what I found very interesting is this just happened about 2 weeks ago. We were playing with his Spider-Man and his Batman, and he looks at me and he says, "Mommy, you don't like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Spider-Man?" And I said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Well, because you're a girl. You don't like that. That's violent." And it really shocked me just knowing, you know, that I don't know where that came from. I don't know, you know, other than when we were growing up, like we just heard that My Little Pony, us girls in the 80s, that's what we were told that we were supposed to like. So here at 4 years old, my son already has that misconception or that preconception that because I'm a girl, I can't like Spider-Man and Batman. Well, at the same time, during the summer, I want him in the garage with me learning how to work on my car.
So, let's get Laura to kind of pick apart what's going on there. Laura, what are your thoughts?
And this is what we see, because even if parents are doing their best, right, or showing different models, it's everywhere. So they're seeing it on the media. They're seeing it in movies. They're seeing it in TV. Peers are huge, like Erica was mentioning. Peers are a huge influence, and they're looking around. And so this is very common as we move to 5 to 6 and even 7, where they're really looking and trying to figure out these differences, and that's where you see it coming from. And, I mean, you're doing the right thing. I mean, they can believe what they want, but you keep showing them other models, too. So as they become more flexible, they will come back around again. This is just a very stereotypical time in their life. But that's why showing them these different models and offering things is important. But, yeah, you're going to get some of those comments.
Let's go to Poppy now in Madison with thoughts on this. Poppy, hi.
Hi.
What's on your mind here about toys?
Well, I just thought it was really interesting because my son, who's about to turn 9, really wanted an American Girl boy doll so that he could play as a dad or as a brother or as a friend. And he loves his doll, Logan, and had asked for his birthday if Logan could have a sister. Because he has a little sister and he wants to act like a dad of a brother and sister team. And I just think that it's so special that he's looking at it that way and not thinking like it's I'm being like a girl.
Erica, it sounds like modeling what's going on around him in the family.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that kids really see these, you know, powerful models in their family, the parents that they have. They like seeing themselves in their toys. And so I think it's great to be able to kind of recreate the things that he loves, which is maybe his family, in his play. It's also really good for those social skills. So one research study showed that when kids, both boys and girls, are playing with dolls, that they actually are enhancing in their social skills. They're often talking to the toys. They're often negotiating roles among the toys, and that can be really good for their development.
Laura, you study how media can shape behavior and thought for children. What have you found when it comes to how children react to toy advertising, how they react to, like, that My Little Pony commercial?
They, like I said, what they say doesn't necessarily reflect how they're responding to it and what they believe. And that's what I was saying, like, in terms of if I watch their emotion, even if they'll watch both ads, even if they say it's okay for both, they're more positive when they're watching those same gender ads than they are for the others. Media's, I mean, it's not the only influence, obviously, but it's a very powerful one, particularly when we look at how much time a lot of kids do spend looking at the media and talking about the media with their friends. So not the only influence, but certainly a very large one.
Let's go to Stephanie now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I'm just wondering about the role of different sex siblings on exposure to toys. I grew up with a brother, and so I grew up playing with, you know, dolls and kind of traditionally female toys, but also Linkin Logs, Legos, and I just wonder if my exposure would have been the same had I grown up with a sister.
Erica, what do you see there with different sex siblings and toys?
Some of the research that I know of has shown that, you know, exactly the case here, where if you have girls with older brothers, they tend to be a bit more masculine in their play because the toys are available. They want to play with their sibling, you know, and so that their toy play can get it to be a little bit more masculine. So if I remember correctly, I don't think it works the other way, though. I don't think that the boys get to be interested in more feminine-type play just because they have an older sister. For boys crossing those gender lines, there seems to be more of a social consequence for that, where girls crossing over into masculine play is accepted by our society. So you might see that a little bit more.
Laura, do you have anything to add there when you have siblings play together of different sexes?
And I will say in my study when I was interviewing the children, one of the things we had come through, if I'd be like, well, why do you think this is for both boys and girls? They would say, because I played with it a sibling. I played with it with a friend. So these interactions with their peers are also very influential in what they're willing to play with or not. And I agree with Erica, obviously, and I found this as well. Pressure from society is a lot more on boys right now than girls.
We're talking about kids and toys and what these toys say to kids about gender and representation. Laura Zimmerman is author and a developmental psychologist. Erica Weissgram is a professor of psychology studying gender development. Gathering your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the toys your kids play with? And when you go down the toy aisle, what stands out to you about gender and culture? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Laura, let's take a look a moment here at toy marketing. Toys marketed for girls, toys marketed for boys, encouraging different types of play. How big of an impact is the marketing and what it's saying?
I mean, it's huge. Kids, like I said, even at three, are already knowing that there are these differences, that they're hearing that girls do this or boys do this. And, of course, our poor gender nonconforming kids don't exist at all throughout here. They're little sponges. They're soaking these messages up, so it definitely makes a difference.
And Erica, is it important that all kids get exposure to educational toys? And how do you define an educational toy?
Well, one of the things that we often say is that, you know, all toys are educational. It just depends on what they are learning. So that, you know, even, you know, the blocks, the traditional blocks or the Lego toys, they are really enhancing those spatial skills. You know, toys that involve a lot of role play, dramatic play, so play kitchens, you know, playing house, that involves a lot of verbal skills. So they are learning. They're learning from each of the toys that they get. The idea is that we want them learning a variety of skills. And in order to do that, you need to play with a variety of toys. So one of the things that I say is make sure that you're, you know, kind of rotating the toys that the kids have, that you're playing different things with them. You're not just, you know, having them play one toy, even if it is their favorite toy, just trying to play with a number of different things. The analogy that I make is that, you know, if your kid loved apples and only wanted to eat apples, apples are really healthy, but only eating apples is not really healthy for them. And so they need to eat a variety of different foods in order to have a balanced diet. Same thing with toys. Even if they love one particular toy, my kids really love Legos. It's great. It's great for their social skills, but they need other kinds of play, too. They need more social play. They need more dramatic play in order for them to kind of be balanced in their roles. So we try to encourage a number of different toys. Some of those toys are going to cross gender lines, and some of them are not.
And we've heard that Mattel, the company that makes Barbie, is introducing new dolls with physical disabilities, one Barbie in a wheelchair, another that has a prosthetic limb. How might this representation be beneficial for kids with disabilities? Erica, you can go tackle that first.
Well, I just think that kids like seeing themselves in the toys. They like seeing themselves represented. It kind of normalizes their experience, you know, there's people out there like them, that we have toys out there that look like them. And I think that's really great for kids with disabilities. I also think it's great for everybody because we can say, look, these are individuals too. They want to join in on the play. So let's go ahead and have a variety of individuals depicted in the toys, and then we can play all together.
We're talking toys, breaking down gender stereotypes, gender roles with our guides to this conversation. Laura Zimmerman is an author and developmental psychologist. Erica Weiss-Graham is a professor of psychology studying gender development. What toys did you play with as a kid? Did it make a lasting impression? Do you steer your children or grandchildren toward or away from certain toys, and does it work? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're looking at gender and toys and the advertising forces behind them here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this month at the annual Toy Fair New York trade show, more than 1,000 companies previewed the toy trends. According to industry experts, toy cars, guns, and trucks dominate the boys' toy market until age 10. Here's a Tonka Trucks commercial from last year that reinforces this generational hold of these rugged trucks.
For 70 years, Tonka and kids have come together to create one epic playtime. With Tonka trucks in your imagination, the possibilities are endless. Operation Rescue, get ready to move in. Mouths of rock and dirt, piece of cake.
So did you play with Tonka trucks as a kid, or maybe another toy was passed down to you from a sibling? Parents, do you try to introduce your child to a lot of different play options? And what is that experience like? What's the outcome? We're at 800-642-1234. Laura Zimmerman is an author and developmental psychologist. Erica Weiss-Graham is a professor of psychology who studies gender development. Laura, going back to that Tonka truck ad there, what do you hear? Because, you know, this has been an institution, Tonka Trucks, for 70 years, as the commercial says, you know, helping cultivate that really rugged off-road experience for little boys.
And exactly, it's for little boys. They have, if you listen to the ad, it's going to be a male voice that's talking about it. They're very loud, right, active music. And the encouragement is, yes, play, but play in this specific, more competitive way. I mean, and that's not a bad thing, but we don't want to exclude it to just one group of children. What's important, like Erica said, right, is we want to have a wide range of experiences so that everybody can explore it and explore it in different ways.
And when we look at those wide range of experiences and we look at Mattel trying to broaden out who Barbie is through the eyes of many different types of children, are we assigning, Laura, too much meaning to representation in toys and children's books and media, or can this really have a profound impact on destigmatizing minority groups?
I think it's huge, and Erica was touching on this, but in children's literature we call it the importance of windows and mirrors. The idea is kids need to see themselves in books. They need to see their experiences. It helps us know we belong, right? It helps us know we relate. And that's wonderful, and all children need to see that. And of course, historically, all children don't see themselves. And we know anecdotally that's huge, that kids do notice if they're not there. And on the other side, windows are important. I need to also relate to and understand others. And so it's important we have these experiences so that we not only belong and understand ourselves, but we also understand there are other wonderful experiences out there, and there are other people that I want to understand and be able to relate to and to accept.
But toys often represent these aspirational themes like superheroes and princesses and characters who are brave. And some might say that that's already pretty far from reality. It's fiction. So can children really feel represented in this land of make-believe?
And I think, I mean, there's two different things going on here. So one, we want them to relate to things in the world and different experiences, either ones they have or others. But another thing you can look at is, I mean, life is hard. And one of the things that kids need to know is they can make a difference, right? If they hang in there, right? If they ask questions, if they work at it, they can make it. So part of what you see in the more superhero line, at least in a perfect world, right, would be that we're giving them that kind of agency. Now, granted, that comes with a whole bunch of other baggage that is less good, but behind it, we do see part of that thrust as well.
And Erica, some people may be hearing this and wondering if we're overthinking this. Kids are kids. Toys are just toys. Does it really matter whether they are inclusive? What would your response to that be?
Oh, I think it does matter. Like I said, I love this mirrors and windows idea that Laura mentioned. We just want to be inclusive so that children that are boys and children that are girls, children in other genders or that are gender nonconforming might see themselves, children of different races and disabilities, they want to see themselves in the toys. And I think that's a really important idea. But also, being able to see themselves or see other children that are different from them might make them more accepting. In the media, they're doing this more often. I know that shows like Sesame Street has always had a commitment to diversity, where they are showing kids from diverse backgrounds playing together, kids of mixed genders playing together, kids with disabilities playing together. And oftentimes they don't even mention it. They're just trying to normalize it. Like, hey, there are many different kids out there, and look at how well they all get along.
Erica, what advice would you have for parents who may feel like they don't have the time or the money or the opportunity to introduce their child to a variety of toys and a variety types of play?
Well, I think everybody can do this. It doesn't really take a lot of time or money. It might just be playing house at home and then playing dragon, you know, the next minute. Looking at the themes of one's play can be really important. Oftentimes just following the kids' leads. Kids, when they're little, especially, you know, in those toddler years and those early preschool years, will play across gender lines and following the kids' leads and seeing what they want to do. Certainly we're not talking about, you know, every child needs to play with every type of toy equally. That would be hard. But following their interests and really seeing if their interests do start crossing those gender lines, being supportive of that, and just, you know, following those interests and trying to develop those skills.
Laura, what would you tell parents who might, you know, say that their child plays with toys that, you know, don't match their gender and match in air quotes? Should they be alarmed and should they cultivate that? Where do you go from there?
I'm a big believer that children should have the choice. Exactly. Follow their interests. Be there. Be supportive. I mean, kids have their own world. They need to explore the world however they want and to go in different directions, and they should have that freedom to do that.
We just saw at the toy trade fair in New York, 1,000 companies presenting all of the toy trends across the landscape. As you look at emerging toys, toys coming out there, and as you roam the aisles, are our toys changing today at all, Laura, or are they the same as they were decades ago?
Oh, they're certainly getting more technological, but a lot of the differences are still remarkably similar. When we look at, certainly if we're looking at it through a gender lens, we see a lot of similarities out there.
And in what ways? What are you seeing that just doesn't break, doesn't, you know, it has really taken hold?
Well, in some of the examples we've looked at, I mean, dolls and trucks have been a major divide. When we look at the construction, toys have been more boys. Again, girls are getting more freedom these days to cross these lines. Boys still really aren't being given this freedom.
And when you monitor the commercials, the advertising, the marketing that is behind these toys, has anything changed there?
Well, I mean, if you take a long enough back, we've shifted up and down, but certainly we are at a period where they are very stereotypical representations. Everything about the ads are designed to target one gender or the other when we look at the more stereotypical toys.
What do you think is driving that? Is it the market? Is it just, you know, what is behind that?
It seems to be partly that our corporations think that's what sells, right? In media, in sales, right, we try to market to sell, but it goes back and forth on itself, right? They're going to reflect what our society sees that they think they can sell, but then they're also influencing society. So, I mean, we see kind of forces from both sides there, but certainly changing marketing would make a huge impact. We have research that shows if we start showing kids counter-stereotypical models, they're going to be influenced by that. But part of that is they can't already have it ingrained before they start seeing those models, because then they're not going to be as effective.
And Erica, you have the last word here. If we could do one thing today to improve child's play across communities, what would it be?
Oh, I think just getting involved in their play. You know, having parents play along with them, I think, is really great. Following the children's interests, you know, leading them in different directions or giving them a variety of toys to play with. All of those things are great. I mean, it's great fun to play with kids. I know we don't always have the time. As a parent myself, I know that. But it's wonderful fun, and you can help direct their play and channel their play to really bring out those cognitive and social skills that they're learning.
Erica, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Erica Weissgram is a professor of psychology at UW-Stevens Point. Her research focuses on gender development and cultural gender stereotypes. And Laura, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Laura Zimmerman is a professor of psychology at Shenandoah University in Washington. Just ahead, how pink slime became ground beef products. We'll talk about it here on the Ideas Network.